This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What happens when a behind-the-lines war reporter tackles climate change?
Because I am citing a lot of the same scientific reports, and I know that a lot of these more well-funded outlets and well-funded and well-backed journalists than I have access to the same information, and yet seeing a lot of self-censorship and a lot of watering down of the information and not giving people the straight story. And it smarts of what I experienced in Iraq of literally being on the ground, seeing things with my own eyes, and then watching them reported completely differently or not reported at all by the bigger outlets back in the United States. And so seeing that same phenomena with climate change has been rather startling and almost goes without saying, adds more fuel to my fire to report it as accurately and timely as possible.
That's Dar Jamil from truthout.org coming up next. Then Peruvian climate activist and feminist Mahendra Acha continues our search for voices less heard.
In my climate activism, I really try to not lose sight of what are the structural causes behind climate change. And so, you know, we talk about CO2 and parts per million and you know, the levels of fossil fuels in the atmosphere and 2 degrees. But really, you know, we can't lose sight of the machinery that's behind that, which is the political system. It's the economic system that isn't letting us move beyond these unsustainable sources of energy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to the journey.
This is Radio EcoShock.
We are on the track of climate truth tellers. Our guest is Dar Jamil, and he's one of them. Dar is a journalist and in the past a war reporter. He's the author of 3 books. Dar has been published in major newspapers in Europe and appears on TV. More recently, especially in the popular blog truthout.org, Dar Jamil publishes deeply researched articles about our climate unwinding into dangerous territory. Dar Jamil, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
What brought you from war coverage to the climate beat?
The primary reason being that it's almost goes without saying the single most important story in everyone's lives today, whether they're aware of it or not. So it was really, you know, a matter of urgency. I'd been watching these changes happening across the planet for a couple of decades before I was able to really dive fully into making this my primary area of focus with my journalism. And so when I transitioned over roughly around 2011, 2012, I felt like I had a lot of ground to make up. And so this, I really can't see this not being my primary area of focus for my journalism ever again.
Well, me too. It is the big story that's going to shape this civilization and really whether humans make it or not, in my opinion. So you penetrated into Fallujah during the 2004 siege, and you reported from Iraq without military protection. How do you think your resistance to the establishment story has shaped your work on climate change?
That's a really good question, because that has been a big factor for me. It's been amazing watching mainstream reporting, and even a lot of the more left-leaning media outlet reporting on climate change, because I am citing a lot of the same scientific reports, and I know that a lot of these more well-funded outlets and well-funded and well-backed journalists than I have access to the same information, and yet seeing a lot of self-censorship and a lot of watering down of the information and not giving people the straight story. And it smarts of what I experienced in Iraq of literally being on the ground, seeing things with my own eyes, and then watching them reported completely differently or not reported at all by the bigger outlets back in the United States. And so seeing that same phenomena with climate change has been rather startling and almost goes without saying, adds more fuel to my fire to report it as accurately and timely as possible.
Well, for me, one of the frustrations is that so often the mainstream media don't come to any conclusions at all. And so you're kind of left thinking, well, is this just natural? Or I guess, is it just happening? And there's no background to it. And there's no doers in it. There's no actors in it.
Well, that's a very important point. And that's also what I saw in Iraq is, the whole issue of context of story is left completely out of the discussion. None of the situation, for example, if a mainstream outlet is reporting on an extreme weather event, whether it be a 100-year flood that's now happening every 5 years, or a record-setting hurricane or typhoon somewhere in the world, it's not most of the time, I mean, there are a few exceptions, but most of the time it's not given in proper context of, well, this is happening because atmospheric temperatures are now more than 1°C above pre-industrial baselines, or this is happening because ocean water temperatures are setting record heat levels across the globe in many parts of the year, even including up in the Arctic and down in Antarctica. So that general context is left completely out of the picture, which is rather astounding because obviously that's the most important part of the story.
Well, let's get right to some of your recent stories, and they're big ones. For example, you wrote, "We have released a monster. Previously frozen soil is breathing out greenhouse gases." What is the monster, Dar?
Well, the monster is, and this was according to a study that was published in the prestigious journal Nature not too long ago, is simply that the monster is that soil which traditionally has absorbed a lot of the CO2 out of the atmosphere is now respirating that carbon back into the atmosphere. Because atmospheric temperatures around the globe are warming apace, the soil is literally having the carbon baked out of it. And so it's a rather disconcerting situation because it's yet another feedback loop or positive reinforcement loop or runaway feedback loop, all three different ways to say the same thing, of what's happening around the globe. And there's currently, some scientists estimate now, more than 60 of these runaway feedback loops. And this one in particular is one of the bigger ones because the aforementioned study has showed that the soil respiration is now adding between 0.45 and 0.71 parts per million of CO2 into the atmosphere every year and will continue to do so between now and 2050. And that's assuming that current climate modeling is accurate, which the study itself says we are pretty confident in saying that these are going to be low estimates and not high enough to keep a pace with reality. So that's a significant amount of CO2 that's now being added into the atmosphere just from soil respiration.
And when I talked to the lead author of that study, Thomas Crowther, he told us this big soil feedback, it's every year as large as the emissions of the United States. It's left out of the climate models that the politicians used at the Paris climate talks. And reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change don't include this soil feedback either. It seems not very surprising to me now these days that the official world is ages back behind the actual science.
And you just gave a perfect example as to why. It makes no logical sense whatsoever that a feedback as massive and as important as this one, for example, would be left out of the climate models. That just makes no sense whatsoever. And so this is why the worst-case scenario, according to the most recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change modeling, shows maybe maximum of 5°C temperature increase across the globe by 2100, which is really rather absurd when we look at it through this lens. And that's why some scientists are talking by as much as a 12°C increase by 2100. While that sounds absolutely shocking, and it is absolutely shocking, when we start factoring in a lot of these runaway feedback loops and a lot of these other studies like this that are not currently being factored into the models, then those start to look a lot more accurate than these rather lowball figures being produced by the IPCC.
I personally doubt that human beings could survive a 12°C rise in less than a century, but we'll bypass that for now. I want to talk about another article you did in December in truthout.org. You said, "The Arctic is unraveling." Now, I know that's a big story. We could talk for an hour just on that, but please do tell us what you mean.
Well, in that quote, "The Arctic is unraveling" is not mine. I should point it out that it comes from a report called the 2016 Arctic Report Card produced by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration here in the U.S. And so that was one of the report's authors who concluded, stating that the Arctic is unraveling, and made such a profound statement because temperatures in the Arctic are, as they always have been and will, really increasing far more dramatically and quickly than around the rest of the planet. And so the report went on to show that, for example, temperatures in December at times, and granted, you know, being in the northern hemisphere as you and I are, most of the listeners are going to understand that December, this is the throes of winter. I mean, December 21st is winter solstice. It's the single darkest day on the planet in the northern hemisphere. And so obviously we're several months into winter in the Arctic, and you would expect some of the harshest temperatures of the year up there. And instead, there were some days in December where we literally had melting on the North Pole in the Arctic, and then other heat waves that had blown through up there that were increased the temperatures, even approaching melting by January 1st, which is just really stunning. I mean, we're talking about temperatures that were 30 and even 40 degrees higher than normal. And that's why it's kind of leaving scientists shaking their heads in disbelief about what's happening up there. And so this is causing permafrost and other areas up there to be releasing more methane than ever. Many areas, even from January to March, so the first part of the year, seeing temperature records as high as 8 degrees C above prior high records. I mean, really just stunning. And I know that you understand this, but I think people need to really understand how shockingly high that is. And then, of course, this bleeds into the ocean temperatures up there, where even more recent reports are talking about how the entire ecology of the Arctic now is shifting, where a lot of species aren't going to be able to survive. Some are migrating out. New species, invasive species now moving in. So literally the entire ecosystem up there is being changed simply by the dramatically increasing air and water temperatures.
Well, related to the unraveling Arctic, but not limited to the Arctic, you also found 2016 was the year of shrinking ice. On Radio EcoShock, Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith mentioned this, but we do need to hear more about it to grasp the enormity of it. Dar, talk to us about what you found.
Yes, this was also a story I did based on analysis provided by the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, which showed that both Antarctica and the Arctic were seeing record new low levels of sea ice extent, both on a daily basis and monthly basis throughout much of 2016. And so that report stated that for the entire year of 2016, sea ice extent both in the Arctic and Antarctica was at levels well below what they consider normal. And if we simply look at what that means, all of the record lows and even the top three record lows are all in recent time frame. And so, for example, in the Arctic, we saw an extent period where it was 193,000 square miles below any previous year on record. And that's just from the period of 2016, from the middle of May through early June. The report goes on to outline a lot of other rather shocking statistics, particularly about how much lower the sea ice extent even in the Antarctic is, and other things happening down there, such as a 300-foot-wide rift running right along the Larsen C ice shelf that was photographed by NASA, so showing that a giant chunk of that ice shelf is very much on the brink of breaking off. And that's going to release an iceberg the size of Delaware into the Southern Ocean. So it's, you know, really, really startling developments that we're seeing unfolding. So it's that's yet another analysis coming out that's showing that in these areas of the planet, the Arctic and the Antarctic, which are literally the refrigerators of the planet or the air conditioners of the planet, particularly in Antarctica, that we're seeing record-setting melting happening.
Well, we're talking about huge physical signs of abrupt warming that can be seen from space, and in the face of this evidence, the incoming regime of Donald Trump will pump out even more greenhouse gases while denying there is a problem. I can't believe this is all Donald Trump. He's not some superhero. Who are some of the people and forces behind this fossil fuel takeover of the American government?
Well, it's literally the fossil fuel industry, other corporate entities like the Koch brothers. You know, those would be the two leading entities that I would point my finger at. And all you have to do is look at who he's brought in as Scott Pruitt to head the EPA, people like Rick Perry in charge of the Department of Energy. He's literally bringing in the jackals of the fossil fuel industry. Yeah, Trump is sort of a more extreme histrionic version of Bush. He's simply the puppet who's very, very effectively distracting much of the media away from the machinery that has been brought in to really carry out the wishes of the fossil fuel industry. And so this is why when you look at his cabinet and you look at other people like Steve Bannon, he's brought in, who's now on the National Security Council, these are the people who are literally running the show. I don't really feel like Trump is an individual who could effectively think his way out of a paper bag. This is not an intelligent individual. He really doesn't know what he's doing. He's clearly got major psychological issues. And so I don't think that left to his own devices, he could really effectively pull off what we're seeing happening with this lunge towards totalitarianism with the U.S. government. And it's from an environmental perspective, looking, he's literally appointing people who have been the single most effective, what's the word for them, patsies, or people basically doing the bidding of the fossil fuel industry in charge of these agencies like the EPA that are supposed to be taking, you know, overseeing policies that take care of the environment and enforce regulations. And they're instead being completely shut down or disassembled before our very eyes.
Yeah, there's been some think tanks like the Heritage Institute or the Competitive Enterprise Institute who are totally funded by the multi-billionaires like the Koch brothers, who've been planning this for years. And so now they're just bringing their big plans into action. TV personality Bill Maher says that maybe our only hope to limit Donald Trump could be the Republicans in Congress. Dar Jamil, are we that desperate?
I think we're beyond that desperate at this point. I think realistically now, looking at the political landscape of this country, Trump's about to appoint yet another arch conservative to the Supreme Court, and we look at the impotency of the Democratic Party. Most of his nominees are just sailing through the nomination process. I see nothing but darkness when I look at the future of the United States, and then certainly what this means now when we look at the global climate. They're going to pull out of the Paris climate deal, which was a non-binding, a bit of a joke. I've been extremely critical of that from the beginning. But even any pretense that this country was going to even pretend as though it was going to do a little bit to mitigate its CO2 emissions, not only is that now completely gone, but it's stomping off the accelerator. Let's put it in the fifth gear. Let's drill. Let's go ahead and push through the pipeline at Standing Rock. Let's get Keystone XL back on the table. It's full steam ahead now off the cliff as we really go off into the climate precipice.
Yeah, what about Standing Rock? I mean, what is that about, for, in case there's anybody left in the universe who doesn't know? And do you think that the protests there will just be crushed by brute force and maybe the Army will build the rest of it?
It's happening as we speak, actually. This just came out yesterday that, you know, when Trump signed yet that other executive order pushing through that and the Keystone XL pipeline, said, no, let's go ahead and move through. That overturns the Army Corps of Engineers' recent decision to not grant the environmental impact statement and say that more work is going to need to be done and we're not going to approve of this. So that's now gone. And so literally we're seeing that push through brutal suppression of the water protectors and other peaceful demonstrators out there trying to block what's happening, they're literally just trying to safeguard their drinking water source. That's essentially the drinking water source for well over a million people. And so we have very draconian measures being taken. And I recently interviewed Jeff Hotz, who's a member of the Standing Rock Legal Collective, talking about the extreme measures that have been going on for months out there, and I think we're going to see increase things like the use of concussion grenades, rampant use of tear gas, rubber bullets, bean bags, things like this, and horrible things. So many people who followed this story are aware that there was an American woman who, a protester, who was shot in the arm with some kind of exploding device from the police, and she nearly lost her arm completely. It's still hanging in the balance, quite literally. Maybe after 10 more surgeries, she'll recover use of that arm. But then what happened was police authorities went into the hospital where she had her surgeries and obtained her clothing and pieces of fragments of that explosive device that were pulled out of her body, and are running tests on them to try to show that the explosive was either set by that woman herself or other water protectors. And so using old FBI tactics that were used during the 60s against activists, trying to sort of blame the victim. And so law enforcement, it's a situation where it couldn't be more clear that law enforcement in the U.S., both on a local, state, and federal level, are literally being simply doing the bidding of the pipeline companies and going out and viciously attacking water protectors, demonizing them. There's now a big push across the country to demonize any sort of protest. There's actually a law that GOP lawmakers in North Dakota are trying to pass that if someone is on a public roadway and they, quote unquote, are accidentally run over, then that the person driving the vehicle would not be subject to charges. And so literally making it legal to run over protesters. So that's what's happening in this country now. And Jeff Haas, when I spoke with him, he concluded our interview by basically saying, I really fear that law enforcement will feel that they have a free hand to use excessive and possibly lethal force now on water protectors. And I think that it's only a matter of time before we see deaths of people in the field who are, whether they're a water protector at Standing Rock or some other demonstrator around the United States. I think that's exactly where this country is going right now.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is journalist, author, and counterculture activist Dar Jamail. Well, I have to ask it, has America just suffered a coup?
I think that my opinion is yes. I think that this country is going headlong into totalitarianism. You simply look at the placement of Steve Bannon, the dramatic consolidation of power that's happening, and who now literally is running the country. And these people have the White House, they have the Senate, they have Congress, and they're about to have the Supreme Court as soon as this next nomination goes through, which the way things are going, there's no reason to think that it won't. So the short answer is yes. And I feel that this country is going into extremely dark times. And of course, given the economic and military power of this country, that's going to send shockwaves around the globe. And I think, this country getting actively, overtly and actively involved in major wars is on the horizon. And those wars have, they've already started against its own people here in the U.S. who are, protests are happening dramatically. There is a huge wave of resistance sweeping the country against essentially everything that this administration is trying to do. And that's heartening and exciting and hopeful. But I think it's only a matter of time before we see a draconian repression of that. And it's becoming illegalized as we speak. And then I think the real question is, after that brutal suppression, then what happens? And I think that will be a key moment in the history of this country and which direction it goes.
Well, rounding back to climate, all this frenetic activity out of Washington has put me and my reporting in a bit of a bind. And I could just give you a quick example. You wrote about how an essential ocean current in the Atlantic could collapse within 300 years. And part of me says, well, I can't think of anything that matters beyond 300 days in this environment. What was that article about, and do you think the long game still really matters?
Well, I did this article because this is such a groundbreaking study that came out in a yet another prestigious journal called Science Advances, and the title of the study was Overlooked Possibility of a Collapsed Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, in Warming Climate, which basically shows that this study, what they did is they corrected for previous biases in climate models and showed that when global atmospheric CO2 concentration doubles from a 1990 level, the AMOC will collapse within 300 years. And as if to underscore that, global atmospheric CO2 concentration in 1990 was 354 parts per million. Right now, it's 404 and climbing parts per million. So we are watching this doubling happening before our very eyes, and again, on a human, not geologic timescale. So this is happening very, very quickly. And so once that doubling occurs, according to this study, the AMOC shuts down within 300 years. And the study admits to being conservative, and it would probably happen well in advance of that. And so once this ocean current shuts down, some of a whole lot of things happen across the planet. But for us in North America and Northern Europe and Western Europe, what this means is we start going back into ice age, dramatic weather pattern shifting, as well as a dramatic increase. This then becomes another major contributor to sea level rise, particularly along the eastern coast of North America, from Florida all the way well up into Canada. Dramatic sea level rise as well. So this is massive. I mean, there was a very over-dramatized, rather horrible movie that came out quite a few years ago called The Day After Tomorrow, basically about this very thing happening. And it's pretty amazing to see that this is now making its way into major prestigious scientific peer-reviewed journals, that it is happening. It's not going to happen overnight as it did in the movie, but still, on looking at a 300-year timescale, it's extremely abrupt, looking through a geologic lens at this. And then, does the long game matter? That's a very good question. I'm not sure that I can answer that, but I think if we look at the fact that humans have never lived on a planet at 3.5 C above pre-industrial temperature baseline levels, and we're already over 1 C, and there are some scientists saying we could even see 6 and 8 C increase by 2050, we're talking 33 years from now. We're talking within our lifetime. So we do start to look at the possibility of, you know, how long do humans last on the planet with runaway climate change? And then again, you know, go back 5 minutes earlier in the conversation, amidst the political context where this country, one of the, you know, in the top three leading CO2 producers on the planet, is just stomping on the pedal now like never before, it does start to look quite grim.
You know, I first read your work in The Guardian in the UK, and of course I did read Beyond the Green Zone, your original book about Iraq, and you've been published in Le Monde in France, you've reported for Democracy Now!, you've been on many TV networks. More lately, you've been publishing in Truth Out. What is truthout.org?
Truthout.org is an independent, left-leaning, internet-based news outlet. We are based here in the U.S. We're 100% internet-based. We are, I would argue confidently, the single most independent news outlet in the United States. We are 90% funded from our readers alone, and then the other 10% grants that we get to support our work are vetted, in that we do not take any monies from anyone that tries to have any sway over our editorial policy. So I am literally in a privileged position of being able to report on what I want to report on and how I want to report on it. And I think we, as an outlet, really walk our talk and do an extremely fine job of covering everything from climate change to what's happening politically in the U.S., and then we have a lot of outside contributors as well. So that is what Truth Out is. People can subscribe to the newsletter. It is free. And especially now with what's happening in this country, we are absolutely committed to taking our reporting to an even higher level and monitoring these centers of power that have just taken over this country.
Well, as we finish up for this time, is there any other topic that you'd like to alert our listeners to?
Well, I think what we've covered, both as far as the crisis of what's happening to global climate and how fast it's happening, coupled with what's happening in this country, I think people are already keeping their eye, certainly the listeners to this show, on both of those things. But I think, you know, just to kind of underscore again what I talked about with what's happening in the United States, I think people need to pay very, very close attention to what's happening here. And I'm recommending everyone read The Origins of Totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt. I think that is even more pertinent right now than reading 1984. So I think that that's what the kind of the lens that people should be looking at what's happening in the United States through at this moment in history.
Please give us a website where readers can find you and your work.
I republish all my articles on my own website that I use as an archive, and it's darjamail.net. That's darjamail.net.
I'll put links to everything we've talked about and your three books in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Dar Jamail, I'm glad we finally connected.
Me as well, Alex. Thanks so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We hear a lot of senior male scientists, politicians, and experts from the big polluting countries talking about climate change. But the first and maybe the worst impacts, they say, will hit women who did little to cause the problem, especially in the global south. And women are taking the lead in climate activism all over the world. In this Radio EcoShock program, we're lucky to connect with Maria Alejandra Rodriguez Acha. She's a young anthropologist, teacher, and activist who co-founded and co-leads an environment group in Peru. Known as Mahandra, she's attended several key climate conferences, including the Paris COP21 meeting. Mahandra, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you get started in climate activism?
I kind of came to it through several different avenues. I would say when I was a teenager living in Peru in 2009, there were protests in the Peruvian Amazon by an indigenous group, primarily the Achuar, against new legislation that was passed by the national government that essentially facilitated the takeover of their lands and the privatization of their lands. And they located a highway in the northern Amazon region of the country and were met with very violent police repression mandated by the central government. Peru, it's important to know that Peru is a highly centralized country. So all of the government decisions, kind of the economic hub, it's all of it is located in Lima. And there's a lot of migration that happens to the city. But what goes on outside of the capital city is often not a political priority. There's not much good communication, good infrastructure, etc. So this was a situation where the central government mandated a strong, aggressive response to a protest, which essentially spiraled into violence, and there were multiple deaths. This was something that was aired on national TV. And it was something that, to me, growing up as someone who is urban, who lives in the city in Lima, but who has traveled significantly around Peru and is familiar with the diversity of both geographically and also culturally of my country, it was just shocking to see these images of violence on the TV screen and to know that this was happening in my country and to feel, you know, how disconnected people living in the city, especially middle classes living in the city, are from these realities and how our governments, our national governments, were taking part of violent repression, and we're responsible for violent repression on our, you know, in our name. So to me, that was something that was just, you know, just like on an emotional level was just very impactful. You know, I mean, because of gender roles, it's the men who are out blockading, but it's the women who are there with them doing the cooking and taking care of the wounded and taking care of the children. You know, I mean, these gender roles exist in all of our societies, and they're expressed in different ways. But in this context, you could also see, like, the specific suffering of women in particular and what that looks like and just sort of the pain and how it's also expressed just so viscerally. So, I think it's, and in general, Peru, we have over 200 current conflicts. These are social environmental conflicts that occur throughout the country, mostly because of dispute around mining projects, around deforestation, around land titles. There are oftentimes protests against legislation, whether it be at the local level, regional level, national level, or companies coming in, foreigners coming in, and essentially taking over indigenous lands. And we have such a weak kind of structure, legal structure, to protect indigenous people's rights to land that we see these conflicts occur throughout the country and people having to mobilize and to take over highways and to, you know, call attention in whatever way they can because the laws don't protect them. It's like historically, they've been historically oppressed and historically marginalized populations. They're not the priority of politicians. The national media doesn't cover these stories. And there's just a lot of discontent, you know, and I think it's historical, it's cultural, it just expresses so many underlying structural factors of inequality and of violence in the country. So to me, growing up, you know, this was just one very kind of shocking instance of that. But it's an ongoing trait that really characterizes Peru and the Peruvian context.
Well, I have to say, though, that some of those same conflicts happened in my own country in Canada, where Indigenous people have been treated terribly for a couple of centuries and a lot of violence towards them. And I also must say that some of the mining companies that are coming to Peru come from Canada. They are mega companies here. Very little awareness of it in Canada. I bet a lot of my Canadian listeners have their pension plans or their mutual funds invested in those mining companies and don't know about it. So that's something that we've got to wake up to at this end. But I'd like to move up to the global, the macro scale here. And I want to ask you, as a woman from the global south, what's your take on the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015?
Yeah. Definitely being there and also, you know, following the more technical process, it was just such a frustrating experience, really, to see that it, you know, kind of unfold in front of me almost and without really the possibility of intervening. So, you know, as civil society observers in official UN negotiations, you can sit in the back. Oftentimes there are limited passes. Sometimes you can't even sit in the room. You have to be outside watching on a screen, which, you know, you might as well not even be there. But if you are able to be in the room, you're sitting in the back, you can't say a word, you can't clap, you can't, you know, show any sign of support or opposition to what's going on. You just have to kind of silently observe what's being decided, really, again, on your behalf. You know, these are our governments, our national governments that are theoretically representing us and our best interests. And so, to me, it was just a very frustrating experience to be sitting in those rooms and in that room and listening to those conversations and really feeling how or really seeing how power dynamics and economic interests and sort of the global political structures, all of that just kind of unfold and play out as well, like on a very real level, you know, seeing how, for example, small island states who say, you know, 2 degrees is a death sentence for us. Like we need to limit warming to 1.5, and seeing there be kind of wrangling and negotiation around that, and in a way blackmail. You know, some things had to be taken out in order for the 1.5 to even be mentioned, and even how it's mentioned, it's like, oh, we'll do our best efforts to limit, you know, pursue efforts to limit warming to 1.5, and that's just kind of, to me, it seems like a token gesture. But it's, you know, 2 degrees remains the limit. And so even for that to be in the agreement, other things have to be taken out. Like, for example, loss and damage, which are, you know, the impacts of climate change to which we cannot adapt, which include deaths, which include the sinking, entire sinking of countries, of island states. You know, that, you know, had to be very much weakened in the agreement. So it feels like it was very much the lowest common denominator in terms of ambition, in terms of also just following what the science is telling us. You know, the Paris Agreement says, like, we must abide by the best available science. But, you know, honestly, I don't see that actually playing out in the negotiations. To me, again, it's the lowest common denominator. Some people have called it, you know, the best possible outcome in an imperfect world, where you have these power dynamics, where you have the possibility of this kind of political manipulation, and where countries can get away without being guided by the best available science, which is telling us that 2 degrees is coming, you know, faster than ever predicted, and that we really are on a path of ever more spiraling global warming, and we're not doing enough in the face of that. So, you know, definitely a very highly frustrating experience. It's definitely better for there to be something, though even this is contested, you know, for there to be some sort of policy structure and some sort of language where I can then go to the Peruvian government and say, well, what are you doing to actually abide by your commitments to limit global warming and to act in the face of climate change. It's something, it's a tool, and activists and advocates and citizens can use that. But at the same time, it's a highly limited tool. And for some, it's even a distraction, you know, from really taking action and from really waking up. Because, you know, I think one thing that the Paris Agreement cannot lead us to is complacency. And is, you know, we cannot just say, oh, sit back and say, oh, governments are taking care of this, because they're not.
That's so true. I want to ask you in particular, does feminism have a role to play in the response to climate change?
So, yes, it does. While climate change does affect humankind, we're talking about global warming, we're talking about planetary scale shifts. Some people are impacted more than others, and that is because of different access to resources, different access to opportunities that can grant us the possibility to be resilient, to adapt, and to protect ourselves, protect our lives, our bodies in the face of natural disasters, in the face of slow onset climate change. So, and it's not a coincidence that often this occurs along race lines, along class lines, along gender lines, along lines of ability, and other categories of inequality that exist in our different societies and communities and spaces that we inhabit, and especially from an intersectional feminist perspective. So recognizing that, again, it's not necessarily all women. It's women particularly in the global south, particularly indigenous women, particularly rural women who live in direct dependence on nature, on forests, on waterways, on timber for food, in those direct dependent relationships, in context of gender-based inequality, where, for example, men are the ones who migrate to cities to access wage labor, and women are the ones who stay behind with the children and rely on subsistence agriculture. You know, in those instances, in when a natural disaster hits, men have more access to resources, money, and kind of the ability to move than women, who are in more direct dependence, again, on the earth and on their natural environment, and who don't have access to this wage income. And we're talking about, you know, this is one instance. There's wage inequality based on gender lines throughout the world, and this varies in different contexts, but there is an overall inequality in our current societies. There's around inequalities around land titles, inequalities around mobility, inequalities around access to political spaces and opportunities and voice and impact on the media. So, you know, gender-based inequality and also racial inequality and class-based inequality and all the forms of inequality that determine and characterize our societies definitely play a significant role in climate change, because, again, while climate, you know, the climate is changing for all of us, some of us have access to certain resources in the face of that and others don't. So on one hand, that's important in terms of vulnerability. I'm talking about impact. But it's also relevant when talking about what knowledge do we have at hand, what practices do we have at hand that can help us in the face of climate change. And this is, again, where gender roles play an important role, because in certain contexts, culturally and historically and socially, women have access to, for example, knowledge around seed saving and knowledge around biodiversity protection that can be very relevant in the face of climate change, because we're talking about the need for protecting seeds and the need for having a greater variety of crops that can adapt to a changing climate. And so, you know, on one hand, we're talking about vulnerability and inequality and the role that that plays. And on the other hand, we're also talking about what tools do we have, what knowledge do we have at hand that can help us face climate change and survive and protect ourselves.
I totally agree with what you just said, and I want to ask you, for women in less developed countries who are worried about climate change, what are the barriers to their speaking and organizing?
I mean, I think it definitely varies from context to context. I can speak about my own environment, my own context. Peru is one of the countries that has the highest rates of femicide, the highest rates of sexual violence and of domestic violence, violence within romantic relationships. And so harassment is something that women face, even from, you know, a daily level of in the household and participating in on a more neighborhood level, to even women in political positions and women who are journalists who face harassment and intimidation based on sexual violence, you know, on a constant basis. So, the violence is definitely a big barrier to women participating and women's voices being taken into account. There's definitely also, huge inequality, along socioeconomic lines. And so land titling is pretty significant, especially in rural areas. And so men are typically the ones who hold land titles, even though women often make up the majority of the workforce on farms. And so women are working but aren't legally owning and therefore don't necessarily have access to credit, for example, or to agricultural support from the government because they're not on paper, even though they might be the ones who are actually living there and working there and the men have migrated to the city. So it's a lot of interconnected factors at play, and it definitely varies from urban areas to rural areas to indigenous communities and what this kind of socioeconomic inequality and also what violence and sexual violence in particular can mean, in these different contexts.
Radio EcoShock.
Well, you are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, speaking with the Peruvian anthropologist and climate activist Maria Alexandra Rodriguez Acha. Mahandra, can you give us some examples of feminist climate activism or of women that have really inspired you?
Sure. I can think of many. I think one group in particular that I would like to mention that is a new group. It's a young group. It's kind of a collection of young feminist activists from around the world who have been engaged in the UN climate negotiations, who are very much engaged at a local level, national level, in organizing and doing activism for climate justice in their context. It's a network called Young Feminists for Climate Justice. It exists as a Facebook platform for sharing information. It exists as a listserv. We got together in Paris in 2015 at COP21, have kind of several projects in mind, have had a webinar last year to talk about intersectionality and feminism and climate justice and what are all of these connections, how is feminism relevant for climate justice and all of that. To me, it's an exciting space because it's open. It's anyone who's interested, who self-identifies as a young feminist for climate justice is welcome to join. There's a lot of potential in spaces like those that are collections of passionate, committed people for whom geographical barriers aren't important, who definitely do have the privilege of accessing platforms like Facebook and having internet access. So definitely diverse, but, there are always limitations to that. And it's important to recognize and to recognize the challenges that we still have to being really, truly inclusive and diverse. But it's a space that I think is exciting and that I think has a lot of potential and that really gathers a collection of people who, again, are so passionate and so committed to activism on a local scale as well.
Well, I'll put a link to that in my show blog at ecoshock.org so people can find it for sure. And in your article in the Huffington Post a while ago, you listed some special days to raise awareness of feminism and indigenous women. Mahandra, what's coming up?
Yeah, well, I would definitely encourage people to check out events going on at a local level. At the same time, it's always good to stay tuned to what's going on in terms of the UN climate negotiations and kind of what our governments are doing on, again, governments that represent us, so on our behalf and to guarantee our well-being, what's being said in the UN climate talk. So there are intersessional climate negotiations in Bonn in mid-May. And then COP23, which is crazy to think about, but it's almost, this year's COP23, and it's going to be in Germany in November. There is the 61st Commission on the Status of Women, which is the annual UN space for talking about women's rights and the progress that governments are taking or have in terms of securing women's rights. And there are multiple, again, conferences and events and things going on at more local and national levels. I believe there's a Young Feminist Leadership Conference in the U.S., I believe in April, if I'm not mistaken.
Lots coming up. Have you heard much about the drought in neighboring Bolivia?
Yes, I've heard some. Tierra Activa, which is the group that I'm a part of in Peru, has a partner organization in Bolivia called Tierra Activa Bolivia, and they've been raising awareness around the vanishing of Lake Popo, which is a lake that has been completely dried out. It has vanished in its entirety. And this is due to the drought. It's due to rising temperatures. It's also due to pollution and deforestation at a local level. So in the case of Bolivia, it's important, especially as foreigners. You know, oftentimes we can hear stories about how the Bolivian government is historic and in that it takes into account Mother Nature and Mother Earth and the rights of nature. But on the ground, it's a government that is still promoting fossil fuel-based development, that is promoting nuclear energy, that is building highways on protected indigenous territories, and that has really, you know, there are tensions currently in terms of national movements and in the indigenous rights movements as well, in terms of the direction that the government has taken, which has been a huge disappointment for many activists in Bolivia, especially environmental activists. And so the partner organization that we have in Bolivia is definitely very vocal about this and vocal about the role that the government has had really in the vanishing of this lake and in the ongoing drought.
Well, right now you're a young feminist fellow, which is a strange term, I think, but please tell us about WIDO, the Women's Environment and Development Organization.
So I am currently actually no longer a young feminist fellow with WIDO, but I was until up to the end of last year. WIDO is an incredible organization. It stands for the Women's Environment and Development Organization. It's an international advocacy organization that primarily attends and engages in international negotiations from the SDGs, which is the Sustainable Development Goal process, and the UN climate talks. And so WIDO supports women to be advocates, to be representatives, to be on official government delegations in those spaces. It attempts to raise awareness, to give out information, and to assist on a technical level. Again, both civil society organizations that are attending these spaces and also the government delegations. So giving information as to the connections between the importance of women's rights and acting in the face of climate change, what one has to do with the other, what women and women-led organizations around the world are doing in the face of climate change, and collaborating with other civil society organizations, again, to raise awareness and to provide technical assistance, to give information, to raise awareness and all of that good stuff. So people should definitely check out WIDO. The fellowship I had was also in collaboration with FRIDA, which is a young feminist fund. So FRIDA gives out small grants to feminist-led youth groups around the world to focus on different issues, and climate justice is one of them. And they have recently closed a current grant cycle, but they open grant cycles up every couple of months. So that's also a really good resource for people interested in finding out more. They have research, they just are a really good hub, again, for connecting young feminists from around the world.
And I know we have a lot of women listeners on Radio EcoShock, and of course we have the men who care about them. What would be your parting thoughts of advice as we face these big changes coming up in the future climate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely important to create community. In my climate activism, I really try to not lose sight of what are the structural causes behind climate change. And so, you know, we talk about CO2 and parts per million and you know, the levels of fossil fuels in the atmosphere and 2 degrees. But really, you know, we can't lose sight of the machinery that's behind that, which is the political system. It's the economic system that isn't letting us move beyond these unsustainable sources of energy that are unsustainable for the planet and also for people. So not losing sight of the connections between the environment and people and inequality. So again, you know, making these connections, environmentalists cannot forget about people, about communities, about indigenous groups, and vice versa. And so when we think about climate change, taking into account these structural causes and what's really behind the problem, then we can also begin to build alternatives that are deep set, that are really transformative, that are radical in the sense of getting to the root of the problem. So if for example, heightened individualism, you know, is part of why we live in this current climate crisis, then we have to be building communities and we have to be strengthening our ties to each other. And we can't work alone. You know, we have to work together. We have to build community because it's good for us, because it's good for the planet, and because that is reversing these power structures that are ultimately, again, unsustainable for the planet and unsustainable for people.
We've been talking with Maria Alejandra Rodriguez Acha from Peru. She's an anthropologist, educator, activist, and young feminist. I'll put short links to a YouTube video with Mahandra, her Huffington Post article, and the organizations we have talked about, all in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. You can follow up there. Mahandra, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Next week from Australia, feminist and professor Petra Checkert talks to us about climate on the ground in Africa and India, plus the new IPCC report on 1.5 degrees C of warming. We'll top that up with a vat of plankton in the new science alerting us to a neurotoxin washing into the seas as the climate shifts. Be sure to join me next week on Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is activist artist David Rovics with a song for Trump Times, Age of the Robber Barons.
There was a time when the rich did not pay tax. Although they lived in mansions while their workers lived in shacks. Back then the wise men said, as long as enterprise is free, the future will be full of great prosperity. The sick and unemployed would usually end up on the street, searching through the garbage for something to eat. In the age of the robber barons, there was a time when land was handed with both fists from the state right to the industrialists. Who profited from war, who profited from peace, who profited from unregulated monopolies, unregulated factories, gargantuan cartels, run by men who knew you'd buy what they had to sell. In the age of the robber barons, there was a time when these barons held the strings that controlled the politicians who give them anything. There were no consequences, regardless of who died. Everybody knew the law was on their side. Never far when needed to defend the property of the Vanderbilts and Stanfords and all those who ruled the country. In the age of the robber barons, there was a time when you could either swim or drown. A time when the whole country was one big comedy town. When the human rights to food or housing were empty words, considered by the barons as patently absurd. It was the age of laissez-faire. Sometimes I repine. I wake up and I think it must be 1899. In the age of the robber barons, the age of the robber barons.